Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Wednesday, March the 3rd, 2021. On this edition of the Politocrat, how safe is safe? A look at January the 6th, and what on earth stops us from being completely attacked again in the next few days or weeks? What stops that from happening? And who has the power to stop that from happening? Christopher Wray testified yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that will be a central focus of this episode. Coming up next. Welcome back. Here we are, the middle of the week, the middle of a brand new week. Now, I want to start with a couple of things before I get to the main thrust of this episode. We have lost a number of people this week already. March is but a day or two old, and we have lost a number of people. Actually, we lost one of the people I'm about to mention sometime last week, and I had not even learned of this until literally yesterday or the day before. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was an institution, particularly here in San Francisco, California, passed away this past week. He was, I believe, 101 years of age. Rest in power. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, one of the major people who, you know, if you don't know who Lawrence Ferlinghetti was, then please do use the internets, if you will, to find out about him. Someone who was tremendous and had a prodigious career. I mean, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, someone that San Francisco celebrated literally a year or two ago. He had his 100th birthday. And I was astonished to even learn of his passing. You know, he I don't want to say much about what he did and who he was, because I really think you should just kind of find out about him. And he literally passed away just over a week ago, and I just learned of this literally a couple of days ago. I mean, 101 years of age. He was born in New York, I'll say that. He died here in San Francisco, California, literally last week. Just over a week ago. About a week ago now. A prodigious career. Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Someone else who passed away just yesterday was the one and only Vernon Jordan. He actually passed away actually on Monday. So 2 days ago he passed away. Vernon Jordan Jr. specifically, was a civil rights attorney, was a hugely influential power broker in politics, particularly inside the Democratic Party here in the United States. And he was someone who was a close personal and political confidant to former President Bill Clinton. Vernon Jordan was a very influential figure, an attorney, civil rights leader, business leader, political power broker, confidant, and somebody who was very influential. Vernon Jordan passed away on Monday night at the age of 85. He will be sorely missed. I must say that I met Vernon Jordan back in the early 2000s in New York City, specifically in Manhattan on 57th Street. I think he was coming out of the Russian Tea Room, that famed venue in New York City, which I'm not so sure is still there. Or at least, if it is, it's not operating at the moment. And it may not ever operate again. I do not know. But I can tell you that I thought I had seen him, Vernon Jordan, coming out of the Russian Tea Room. And I was walking up 57th Street towards 8th Avenue, or at least in that direction, towards Broadway at least. And I saw this tall man, tall black man. I mean, you couldn't miss him, wearing a navy blue, dark navy blue, midnight blue suit. And he had this tie on, and he was dressed immaculately, and he carried himself with a certain air. And you could just see who, and I knew instantly that this was Vernon Jordan. I instantly knew. And I stopped and said, "Hello, Mr. Jordan, how are you?" And he said, how are you? And I said my name, and I introduced myself, and I said, you know, I'm an attorney. And he said to me, "Well, that's great, it's nice to meet you, and we have at least two things in common." And he smiled, and I laughed, and he laughed. And then we bid each other goodbye, and we went our separate ways. He walked down 57th Street toward 6th Avenue, and I walked on up 57th Street toward, I guess it was either 7th Avenue or Broadway, whichever comes first. I'm a New York person all the way in terms of being, I lived there for a number of years, and I can't even remember what comes first, but that's not good. But all of that is to say that I turned around and looked to watch Vernon Jordan walk down 57th Street. And I was just trying to take in the fact that I'd just met this giant of a person, not just literally, but figuratively. And I don't normally do this, but I turned and I watched him for a good 10 to 15 seconds as he kept walking toward 6th Avenue. And I thought to myself, you know, I just met Vernon Jordan, a legend, Vernon Jordan Jr., a legend, tremendously influential person. Well-respected, someone who led the fight in civil rights. It was a key civil rights attorney back in the day. Very influential, highly respected, very decent person. Wrote a book here and there. And it was just great to meet him for those few moments. It was probably about 30 seconds that we interacted. And in a city like New York City, where the everyday person leaves famous persons to themselves, which is why a lot of famous people love New York City, because they are left in relative anonymity. It was just incredibly amazing that nobody even noticed this 6'5" man just walking through the throngs of New York. Nobody stopped to think, this is somebody that I recognize, or this is someone who may be famous. Nobody thought that. I'm sure if they did, they didn't pay any mind to stop him in the street. And he didn't seem to mind that I did stop him and say hello to him. Vernon Jordan will be sorely missed, and I will always treasure that moment and that memory of meeting Vernon Jordan Jr., in the street, on 57th Street in New York City, just for a few moments. And forgive me for going on about my personal story, meeting Mr. Jordan, but it's a memory I'll never forget. I should also add that Vernon Jordan passed away, as I said, yesterday. Monday. I believe it was in his sleep. And I am not able to discern, at least as of now, whether it was natural causes or not. But Vernon Jordan Jr. will indeed be sorely missed. Last but certainly not least, Bunny Wailer passed away. And he passed away yesterday on Tuesday. He is a major loss for reggae all over the world. He was one of the giants of reggae back in the 1970s, in the 1960s as well. He was part of the group that Bob Marley formed called the Wailers. Actually, also Peter Tosh, one of the other greats in reggae, reggae giant like Mr. Marley, also founded that group, the Wailers. Bunny Wailer was one of the central figures in the Wailers, and he was an icon on his own as well. Bunny Wailer contributed massively to reggae and was a very key figure indeed. Today, the reggae world and the world of music in general mourns the passing of Bunny Wailer, one of the great icons of reggae, and someone who is mourned, as I said, all over the world. He passed away yesterday. What a loss he is. And it's really something when you consider Bunny Wailer, the career that he had. And it's sad that he is no longer with us. And it's hard to believe. He was one of the co-founders of the Wailers as well, I should add, but it's just hard to believe he's no longer here. Just 73 years of age. Wow. We are losing these great people. And it seems as if we are losing them all on a daily basis. I know in life that tomorrow is promised to nobody. I know in life that at some point, all of us will no longer be here. And I know in life that times can be tough. Sometimes much tougher than they should ever be. And I know in life that there are good people who die young. And I know that there are good people who live a long time. And relatively speaking, I would say that though 73 is young, Bunny Wailer lived certainly a fairly long life compared to some other people on a daily basis who we never know, who pass away early. I would say that Vernon Jordan lived a long life at 85, and I would certainly say that Lawrence Ferlinghetti lived a long life at 101. May they all rest in power. Welcome back. Thank you, by the way, for your indulgence in that previous segment, because I just think it's important to begin with the names of people who have passed from this planet. And there are people you can add to that list that perhaps you know of that perhaps most of the world does not know. Most of the world may not be aware of. Someone in your family. Someone that you know who's dear and close to you. So forgive me for beginning that way. I think it's important to, though. And these are three very different people, but three people who really did make their mark for good in the world, really, in their different disciplines. And again, I do encourage and ask that you find out who Lawrence Ferlinghetti is. Ferlinghetti. Lawrence being spelled with a W, Lawrence. Please look up who that is. And while you're at it, look up Bunny Wailer, spelt the same way as the rabbit is spelt, Bunny, and then Wailer, Wailer. And look up Vernon Jordan Jr. as well, Vernon Jordan, Vernon Jordan, as in Michael Jordan, Vernon Jordan. Look up all three of them. I think you can get to learn a little bit about them. Hopefully the information is accurate enough. I'm sure that the gist of it is, but I would hope. Because, of course, everything on Twitter and everything on Wikipedia and everything anywhere else on the internet ain't necessarily accurate. But please, go to some good sources and search out those three individuals and get to know a little bit about who they were. Because they really were, in their own ways, very special people who brought some really good things to this world. And I want to just add something to this, because creativity is the engine that really drives us. Love, creativity, joy, you know, and good health, obviously, too. But joy, love, creation, creating things. There's so much destruction that goes on. War, poverty, militarism, racism, genderism, misogyny, misogynoir, transphobia, homophobia, attacks against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, attacks against gay and lesbian and transgendered individuals, and against black trans women in particular, brown trans women as well. And there's so much destruction and vitriol. And then there's creativity. And then there's invention. And then there's writing, and there's sketching and painting and drawing and observing and photographing and singing and dancing and loving and music playing. And there's so much creativity that drives this world forward. And so even in these very difficult times with this pandemic that's going on, let's hang on to those things that really do energize and innovate us. The joys of watching professional athletes compete. The joys of listening to a concert that gets shown on TV, rebroadcast, or rebroadcast in your mind. The joys of listening to that piece of blues music or jazz music. Two classical art forms like those. The appreciation of Beethoven or Mozart. The appreciation of Sister Rosetta Tharpe. The appreciation of those who create great things. Those authors that you read who weave lessons of poetry and warnings to us all. They do us the most critical of public services, and they enlighten us as well. Or that escapist novel that you read last week or finished just today or yesterday that fills your heart with something, if only for a few short weeks or days or hours. As we live in a world that continues to be extremely challenging and toxic at the very same time, and joyous and loving, and horrendous and tragic, and cruel, and optimistic, and beautiful. By the way, I want to also urge you to wear a mask. Wear two of them, please. And I'm not plugging them, but I am plugging them. Born Basic, that's the name of the brand, and I will put them in the liner notes of this episode, because Born Basic is a tremendous brand of mask. I really do love what they do with their masks. They are free, 3-ply, the standard. They're not N95s, but they are pretty darn good. And ever since I encountered Born Basic, I've had a love affair of sorts with them. I cannot stop trying to find masks that are Born Basic brand. And it took months to find them again. Because in this corner of the world, in San Francisco, California, you couldn't find Born Basic anywhere, in any grocery store, for months, literally dating back to November of last year, 2020. And now that March has begun, Born Basic, at least in a grocery store near yours truly, returns. Make sure you get Born Basic, or you'll be basic without them. Wear a mask. Please wear two masks and make sure you make them Born Basic. That's my unofficial plug for Born, B-O-R-N, Basic, as it sounds, as it's spelled. Now, I want to get to, finally, the main focus, which is where we stand on this planet. It's a very insecure planet that we're living on at the best of times. The environment, the climate, it's all shot to hell. It has been shot to hell for decades, if the truth be told. And we have not done much to turn the tide against that. In fact, as Sir David Attenborough, the botanist and environmentalist, and broadcaster said just last week, it is already too late to slow down and reverse the effects of global warming, climate change, and the perilous destination of this environment that we all swimming in. And that brings me to this question of security and safety. What does that mean to you? What does security mean? What does that mean? What does safety mean? How are we safe or safer? And, you know, naturally, I turn my attention to the United States of America. Because in yesterday's episode, I was talking about how we can be so rich as a nation and yet selectively behave as if we don't have any money at all. And I say selectively because obviously we've got money for war, we've got money for keeping brown people out, and some black folk too, out of the country. We've got money for that. We've got money for separating kids from their parents. We've got money for those kinds of things. But we don't seem to have it for stimulus checks or for COVID-19 relief. Or at least it takes months and months for a package to even unfold. And the Senate still hasn't taken it up yet. And it's scheduled to do so this week. But yet the military defense bill, that gets passed in 2 minutes flat. And there's no Senate parliamentarian talking about, well, this can't happen. Yeah, we're fighting to keep a $15 an hour provision in the Senate bill for COVID-19, $1.9 trillion relief. I talked about those kinds of things in yesterday's episode. But I turn my attention to this whole notion of safety because we were, as we were almost 20 years ago, and 20 years is going to mark it. This coming September 11th will be exactly 20 years ago that the terrorist attack happened. The one where, you know, at least 15 people from Saudi Arabia drove planes, hijacked people, drove planes into buildings, and yet nothing happened in terms of accountability. I mean, yes, okay, the U.S. bombed Afghanistan, but why? And then went to Iraq and bombed that. And yes, they got Bin Laden, but what happened? They decided to kill him instead of bring him to justice. Why? Is it because he had secrets to tell about the CIA that trained him? I mean, I don't know. The CIA did train him, by the way. That's not me just off the cuff. And I don't say things off the cuff. When I say things, dear listeners, you, I think, know by now, I say them based on factual information. And if the facts are incorrect, or if rather, if I get it wrong, I will say so. And I will correct. Generally speaking, that is the case. Pretty much almost every time I can think of no times I can remember where I failed to. But if I have failed to, you will let me know, won't you? And you can definitely email this podcast at politocratpod@gmail.com. That's politocratpod, politocratpod@gmail.com. But I really do wonder about this whole thing because, again, coming up in September, a little bit more than 6 months from now, exactly, September 11th, 2021, will mark exactly 20 years. And in the intervening time, we have had the most, I think, or arguably really two of the most egregious, in fact, many more than two. We've had multiple terrorist attacks in the United States since September 11th, 2001. Can you guess what I'm getting at when I say that? Can you guess what I mean when I say we've had multiple terrorist attacks? Well, think about this. These mass shootings. I would argue that the mass shootings in this country, whether it's Sandy Hook, whether it's the Pulse nightclub, whether it is the high school there in Florida, I forget the name of that high school, and it's just killing me the name. Marshall, I forget what that high school was in Florida, where that gunman killed people. And you had David Hogg and you had other people. You know the high school I'm talking about there in the Valentine's Day, as it's called. I hate the way they call these things. The so-called Valentine's Day massacre from 2 or 3 years back. You remember, if you were here in the United States or if you're beyond somewhere else in the world, you've probably heard about that. The mass murders in El Paso, Texas, the mass murders in the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania, the mass murders at Mother Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and I can go on and I can go on and I can go on. And of course, almost 2 months ago now, the terrorist attack on the United States Capitol building. All of those are terrorist attacks, and all of those, without any exception whatsoever off the top of my head, were committed by white men. And so the national security threat in the United States is not someone from Saudi Arabia, is not someone who happens to be of the Muslim faith, is not someone who is black or brown. It is white men, and it is violent white men. They are the national security threat. And as I said, the system is too, really, in a way, because it perpetuates and props this stuff up and engineers it. Because there is no way that January 6, 2021, that terrorist attack, there's no way that could have happened without advanced knowledge and acquiescence. You would not have a scenario where some black folk get to just wander in to the U.S. Capitol carrying mace and pipe bombs and bear spray and knives and zip ties and guns. And you would not have that scenario if that were black people. You wouldn't have that scenario. Those black folk wouldn't have got anywhere near the entrances. They would have been mowed down. If you don't believe me, just look at what happened in June of last year, 9 months ago now, when there were Black Lives Matter protests on the steps of the Capitol. And that whole Capitol was shut down because you had a trillion National Guard all over the blooming place. If you don't believe me, look at what happened on June 1st of last year, when the previous occupant of the White House got all kinds of military police and all of that to fire tear gas on peaceful protesters who were just walking through Lafayette Park, Lafayette Square. And they had these tear gas canisters fired at them. It was just, and then they had cops beating up journalists from Australia or any other. They were just doing their jobs. Doing their jobs. And then you got this fool posing with a Bible upside down, just the way Hitler did. I mean, this is so obvious that these Republicans are Nazis. You shouldn't even be calling them Republicans anymore. Call them Nazis, because that's exactly what they are. CPAC last week, that conservative, whatever the hell they are, with their little convention, and the whole stage is designed in Nazi regalia. It's the whole thing is designed as the Nazi stage was years back. It's not an accident. These guys are telling you that in order for us as white men to stay in power, we've got to get violent. And we are appealing to you thugs and you white terrorists and you violent white men that this is your home now. We're not pretending anymore. We're not even going to bother wearing the sheets. And in that particular vein, I bring you FBI Director Christopher Wray. No, he's not a Klansman, as far as I know. He is someone who has many times before Congress, before the Senate in particular, particularly the Senate Judiciary Committee, has testified on a number of occasions. Also, I think the Senate Intelligence Committee as well, but on a number of occasions testified that white male terrorists inside the United States are the greatest threat to national security of the United States. And Christopher Wray has testified to this on a number of occasions. There have been reports, there have been this, there have been that. I remember in the Obama administration, there was a shelving of a report by the, I believe, National Security Advisor at the time, Janet Napolitano. Or she may have been the Homeland Security person, I think she was. Homeland Security Director. She had to shelve a report that talked about all this violent white extremism and this terrorism. And then Christopher Wray, the FBI Director, testified a number of times to this. Some people were awake, other people didn't care. And there were many, many warnings about what was going to happen on January 6th, least of all from the guy that just got his butt kicked in the White House by this country. You, as voters, kicked his ass out. And he got impeached again. And all he did was tweet when he had a Twitter account to use. And he tweeted all about this stuff all the time and on Facebook and all everything else. Everything else. And then it was known for weeks, for 3 weeks, that there was going to be this mass descending upon the U.S. Capitol for 3 weeks. And was much done about it? No. Not much was done about it at all. And that is the definition of an inside job. And you can call me cynical, you can call me conspiratorial even. But I reject both of those. Although the cynicism thing, maybe. But no, this is not conspiracy. This is common sense. And I know. I get it, dear listener. Common sense ain't all that common anymore. In fact, common sense ain't common anymore. You probably know that from speaking to people you thought were rational, but then their true colors really bellowed at you during COVID times, which we are still going through, of course, as you know well. But all of this is to say that just yesterday, FBI Director Christopher Wray, who I think has been decent for the most part, I've got some quibbles with the FBI in general, as I've alluded to, their long history of not being a friend to black folk at the very minimum. And Mississippi Burning, that movie from 1988, which portrays Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe as these Avengers on behalf of these FBI Avengers on behalf of black people. Oh, how noble. And nothing could be further from the God's honest truth. But FBI Director Chris Wray struck me as, and I speak in the past tense for a reason, as a decent person who was doing what he could in the FBI. I have my criticisms of him. But he was very clear about this violence that was coming from white men and all of these groups. And I'm not going to mention all their names because you know all their names. But he laid a major egg yesterday during testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he had both Democrats and Republicans upset at him. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of, I forget where he's from now, Rhode Island? Ah, dear, I can't believe I blanked on where he's from. I know Jack Reed is from Rhode Island, but gosh, why can't I remember Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and where he's from? But anyway, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was not happy with him, the Democratic senator. And the Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah, the old originalist who believes you've got to look right at the Constitution for what was said in 1787 when the blooming thing was ratified and, you know, and all that. At the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. He believes that, you know, when black folk were in chains and enslaved and, you know, that's Mike Lee. And he was upset at FBI Director Christopher Wray. And they weren't the only two. Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, he was upset too. He was not a happy camper. And there were others. And there was a cavalier way in which FBI Director Chris Wray sometimes addressed some of these questions. And his demeanor and his posture were, in my view, rather troubling. And I really didn't like it. I'll get over it, of course, but I didn't like it. And of course, if you were not able to watch or hear any of the hearing that took place yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where FBI Director Christopher Wray was the one and only witness testifying about the events of January 6th and what, if anything, the FBI did to prepare properly to deal with that event and to deal with the aftermath. What steps did the FBI take? If you missed any of that, I've got some good news for you. There are some clips that I am going to play. And you have to ask yourself, how secure are we inside the United States of America right now? You can listen to some of these excerpts I'm going to play and ask yourself that question. You can start asking it right after this. Welcome back. So here are the clips, and you will hear the clips of some of the senators yesterday questioning FBI Director Christopher Wray about the FBI and its role prior to the January 6th, 2021 terrorist attack on the United States Capitol building, where they were sitting. They were sitting inside that very building yesterday. And the answers, some of the answers that Director Wray gave were very unsatisfying. And some of the senators took the time to make that clear, to make that known to FBI Director Wray. You're going to be hearing from Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. You're going to be hearing from Senator Dick Durbin. You're going to be hearing from Senator Mike Lee. You're going to be hearing from Senator John Kennedy. And some of the responses. I don't know that in a nation where there's a lot of insecurity to begin with, the economic situation in this country now has absolutely gone to the dogs. The infrastructure in this country has been dead on arrival and non-existent for more than 40 years now. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. You were so kind to us. And the future of the country itself is in very open question, because you've got a Democratic administration right now, at least in some part, who seems to be very, very, I have to say, aloof in some ways. And the more that I hear people talking about building back better, and we've got to address systemic racism, the more that I hear that being said, not only the less convinced I am, but the more dangerous in terms of where are they going with this? Because you can't tell me that you're dedicated to trying to eradicate or address systemic racism, and then we still have to beg you to overrule the Senate parliamentarian saying that $15 an hour as a minimum wage should not be in this bill and cannot be in the Senate bill. You can't be talking about we want to address systemic racism and we want to deal with equity, racial equity, whatever that means. And so far you haven't overruled the Senate parliamentarian around this $15 an hour minimum wage. You've not overruled that person yet. We have to put out petitions for you. We have to go out there and call you on the White House switchboard at 456-1414-202 area code. Or the comments line at 456-1111-202 area code. I mean, we have to do that just so that you can then overrule the Senate parliamentarian. Well, if you wanted to deal with systemic racism anyway, other than just paying those two words lip service and buzzword status, then this situation with the Senate parliamentarian would have been dealt with forthwith on the very day that she uttered those "I can't do this for you, man" words, re the minimum wage, $15 an hour provision. But I digress. I think it's time now for you to listen to the senators coming up. First of all, you're going to hear Dick Durbin first, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Then you're going to be hearing, I believe, from Senator Whitehouse. Then you're going to be hearing from, I believe, Mike Lee. And then after that, it's going to be John Kennedy. Two Democrats followed by two Republicans.
Really won on November 3rd, President Trump. The next big lie appears to be the argument that somehow or another those were not Trump supporters who invaded the Capitol. It made the rounds on the internet right before they came into the building and has been gaining momentum ever since. I'd like to ask you, Director Ree, do you agree that the Capitol attack involved white supremacists and other violent extremists?
Certainly the Capitol attack involved violent extremists. As I said, we, the FBI, consider this a form of domestic terrorism. It included a variety of backgrounds. Certainly there were quite a number. We're seeing quite a number as we're building out the cases on the individuals we've arrested for the violence. Quite a number who what we would call sort of militia violent extremists. So we've got a number who self-identify with, you know, the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers, things like that. We also have a couple of instances where we've already identified individuals involved in the criminal behavior who we would put in the racially motivated violent extremists who advocate for what you would call for white supremacy. So there have been some of those individuals as well. One of the things that's happening as part of this is that as we build out the cases on the individuals, when we arrest them for the violence, we're getting a richer and richer understanding of different people's motivations. But certainly, as I said, militia violent extremism, some instances of racially motivated violent extremism, specifically advocating for the superior of the white race.
Based on your investigation so far, do you have any evidence that the Capitol attack was organized by, quote, fake Trump protesters?
We have not seen evidence of that at this stage, certainly.
Thank you.
Do you know how many questions for the record the FBI failed to answer in the last 4 years?
I do not.
Well, I'll tell you, there were 9 hearings in this committee in which the FBI was a witness, and in 7 of them, the committee got exactly 0 questions for the record. 7. 0 questions. Can you explain that?
I cannot. I will say...
Are you going to do any better with the questions that we're getting right now? You've been asked questions for the record. Are they going to go into the same... whatever it was, hole, where questions for the record go to die at the FBI?
Well, Senator, first thing I would say about questions for the record is that, as you may know, there is an elaborate interagency process that requires that answers that we provide have
yeah,
to get
which is immensely convenient for the executive branch. But our questions don't direct that interagency process, do they? And that interagency process doesn't respond to us in Congress, does it?
We're required to comply with the interagency process to provide our responses to questions for the record.
By what?
Now, having said that,
are you required to comply with that interagency process?
I can't cite you the reg or the rule.
Because it seems to me that when the FBI wanted to get information to this committee, particularly when it wanted to get information to Republican members of this committee so they could investigate your investigation of the Trump-Russia connection, that information got right through to our Republican colleagues. It didn't seem to go through any interagency process. It wasn't delayed. What we seem to have is for most of us, but this was bipartisan, by the way, when I say we got 0 questions for the record answered from those hearings, I mean 0 questions of any member of this committee, not 0 Democratic members answered. Okay? So you've got this basic highway for responses to Congress. Let me ask you just a little sidebar. Do you think Congress deserves responses to questions from executive agencies as part of our oversight responsibility?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good. So we're at least over that hurdle. So we've run this rigmarole with the interagency process in which we don't get answers. Some of these go back to 2017, by the way. That's years of not getting our questions answered. And then, when it's a question that's suddenly of interest to one party and to President Trump, there seems to be a little side road that gets built around the traffic jam. And stuff just flies right through. So please don't tell me about interagency process when I've been sitting in this committee watching FBI information get straight to this committee without interagency process. What are we going to do about this? Is this a problem?
So, Senator... let me say first, as I said, that I absolutely agree with you that Congress needs answers to its questions. I am frustrated as well at the process. I have added more staff, and my understanding is that when it comes to correspondence, for example, which just doesn't require the same interagency process, that we have significantly reduced the backlog and the turnaround time. But there's no question in my mind.
We had
no question in my mind.
8 letters go unanswered. The oldest one dated March of 2017. So if you think your process is working, we're not seeing it on our end.
Well, I will commit to you that I will do what I can to improve the process. I am frustrated as you are, and we have obviously we need to get better.
Well, I will commit to you that I'm going to make sure that this gets done. And if it means stopping nominees, if it means doing whatever it takes to get through this problem, we're going to get through this problem. Because it is just plain wrong for the executive branch of government in a separation of powers country to refuse to answer questions of the elected representatives of the legislative branch. It's just wrong. And however many excuses and however much rigmarole the executive branch may set up to slow down those answers, I don't care. That's your executive branch rigmarole. That is not a legitimate answer to a legislator's question. And I got stuff that's now backed up for years. Now, the courts have said that they don't want to intervene in enforcing our subpoenas. I'm not sure we can get subpoenas in a 50-50 committee, but assume we could. The courts have said they don't want to enforce it. So you guys can put our subpoenas in the same file with our letters and our QFRs and not answer them. And then what happens is the courts have said, the way we resolve this is we've got to hit you legislatively. The court said we should hold up appropriations for the FBI and for executive agencies that aren't responsive. That's our tool. Your people do good work, Director Wray. I don't think you want that to be our tool. But you can't be in a situation in which you don't answer our questions, you create rigmarole log jams, and when there's a political interest in getting information out to the committee, suddenly none of that rigmarole pertains. Suddenly, everybody gets their hands on all the information that they need just as soon as they need it. And by the way, I believe on a partisan basis, not shared with both sides of the committee. So before we get to clearing up whatever else we need to get cleared up, all the stuff that's backed up behind our questions, we got to get through the problem of why you're not answering our questions. And we've got to clear that up. And I don't know how we clear that up. I think we clear it up, Mr. Chairman, in a bipartisan fashion, because I think both sides should get this. But this business of years going by, of hearings in which zero QFRs get answered, and letters that get thrown off into the don't care to answer that one pile. Woodrow Wilson once said that the oversight function, the investigative function of Congress, is often to be preferred even to its legislative function. We got to get that back. And I'm going to find a way with this committee and with you to clear the backlog. I don't think you think that I should give up on questions because I've been stonewalled for years. If I've asked them and they deserve answers, they should be answered. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. My time is up. We'll leave it at that.
Mr. Chairman, if I just may add, with your indulgence, one point. Senator, I commit to working with you to try and see how we can improve our responsiveness and to getting you more of the information you need. The one thing I will say is that I can assure you that in terms of my responsiveness to this committee, to the members of this committee, or to Congress overall, it is absolutely not, speaking only for myself now, on a partisan basis.
Well, you run an organization that seems to have operated under very different rules. And it was you running that organization. So let's not make these distinctions right now.
Increasing the standard for warrants under Section 215 to require a probable cause and requiring a probable cause warrant to obtain internet search history, internet browsing history, and geolocation information. Are those reforms that you'd be willing to support?
Well, Senator, I'd be happy to work with you to provide sort of operational assessment of the impact of different legislative ideas. Certainly, we view our responsibility as not just to protect the American people, but also to uphold the Constitution. And we say that every day in the FBI. Certainly, I would want to make sure that any legislative changes to FISA didn't have unintended, very damaging impact on everything from our sharing of information with our foreign partners, our intelligence community partners, that we didn't elevate the standard in FISA above the level of what we could get, for example, in an ordinary criminal case, things like that. But we'd be happy to engage with you on the subject.
Mr. Chairman, my time's expired. Can I add one sentence at the end just to complete the thought? Thank you for your willingness there. We have been told over the last 10 years since I've been here, we will work with you. We will work with you has translated into opposition from inside the FBI every single time we've tried to bring about one of those reforms. Every time. As sure as the sun will come up in the east tomorrow, we've been told by the FBI, you can't do that. Don't worry, we've got it with our own internal controls. I hope you'll be sympathetic to me this time around, recognizing that I've been told that over and over and over again. And we're not going to accept that answer anymore. Thank you.
Mr. Director, I've listened from my office to your testimony today. Tell me who had the authority to call out the National Guard on January 6th.
My understanding is that the decisions to call out the National Guard, in one sense, are the responsibility of the Secretary of Defense, but in another sense, have
okay.
to be...
Mr. Director, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think we can agree that the FBI had credible information that there was likely to be violence on January 6th. Can we agree on that?
Well, I don't know that we had assessed its credibility. We certainly had information that was concerning about the potential for violence in connection with the January 6th events. And as we've discussed here this morning, one piece of information that was most specific that I'm aware of was passed, quite
quickly. Well, based on that information, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we just keep nibbling at the edges and dancing around the issue. And I understand. I'm not asking to throw anybody under the bus, Chris. I get it. But we need to find out what happened. Now, if you were king for a day, based on the information that you had, maybe not at the time, but later on, would you have called out the FBI? I mean, the National Guard?
You know, Senator, as you said, I really want to be careful not to be armchair quarterbacking others. I think the National Guard, we have seen, can play a very important role
okay.
in crowd
control. Excuse me for interrupting.
Yeah.
Boy, I sure, I'm not trying to be rude, but my time's limited. Who made the call not to, based on your information, who made the call not to call out the FBI, whether they should have or shouldn't?
Not to call the FBI?
I'm sorry, I'm tired. The National Guard.
I would defer to others who were more involved in that discussion, but from what I have heard, what I have read, my understanding is that at one stage of the process, the local government was of the view that it did not need the National Guard's assistance.
Who do you mean by the local government? The mayor?
Yes.
So the mayor didn't call out the National Guard?
At the beginning.
What do you mean by the beginning?
Well, in the day or two leading up to the 6th.
Okay.
Then as to exactly how it played out on the 6th itself,
I mean, clearly our people were overrun by the nut jobs. So we're making progress here, okay? So the mayor... or the city government decided not to call out the FBI, National Guard ahead of time. What about the House Sergeant at Arms?
I don't know what role the House Sergeant at Arms played with respect to the National Guard.
Okay. How about the Senate Sergeant?
Same answer.
Okay. How about the Capitol Police, the chief of Capitol Police? Did the chief of Capitol Police make the call not to call out the National Guard?
I don't know the answer to that. My understanding is that the law enforcement officials here with responsibility over the Capitol, that there were differing views about whether or not the National Guard was appropriate and when at what level. But all I really know on that is what I've, same thing you've seen, you know, in the press coverage of the events.
Okay, that's enough on that.
Now, after hearing what you just heard, dear listener, after hearing what you just heard, you surely must come to the conclusion that we are far from being a safer country. And it is certainly up to our local, state, and federal government to do all they can to make this country a safer place in which to live and a better country in which to live. We all share in that, but particularly people in political power. And it all starts locally. It all starts locally. What we do locally, how we engage with local political figures. Do you write to your congressperson locally, your assembly person, your city council person, dog catcher, school board? How often do you find yourself on a local level engaging with those individuals? The answers to those questions, I think, are very important. Because as many times as I have sat here and said to you, dear listener, that you must call your congressperson, your senator, or you must leave a comment with the White House on their comment line, or you must try to lobby Vice President Kamala Harris or President Biden or both of them. As much as I've said that, it really does start locally. It really does start locally for all of us. And if you are not engaging on any kind of a basis with your local politician, with the people who represent your neighborhood, your district, then you really should. You really should be doing that. You vote them in. And if you don't know what they're doing, take a couple of minutes out of your busy time. And it might just literally be 5 minutes. It doesn't have to be an hour. Take 5 minutes, 10 minutes max, to find out what they are doing, to contact them, to look them up, and find out what they're doing. Get on their mailing lists. Do a search of them. Find out what your district is. Maybe you don't know what your district is. Many people do not know what congressional district they live in. They don't know what assembly district they live in. They don't have any idea. They barely know who their two senators are. And the truth is that most of us do not engage in politics on any day-to-day basis. Less than 10% of the country here in the United States actively engages on a daily or regular basis with politics. And that's really stark, but it's true. Most people just want to get through the day. I mean, we all want to get through the day. Some of us do want to engage with the political affairs of the day, though, because that's important. Politics affects everything. Everything we do is political. Everything. Pretty much every decision we make is based on some kind of political consideration. Think about that. Think about that. Whether you go to Trader Joe's or go to Whole Foods is based on some kind of political consideration. You've got to think about money. You've got to think about, can you afford it? You've got to think about how much can you buy? You've got to think about if you have children, what you're going to do there. You've got to think about if you don't have children, how much of a budget do you have? You've got to think about all these. That's all based on politics. This is what politicians have to do. They have to think about, well, if I make this move, how is it going to look for me here or there or my re-election bid? Or what are those donors over there going to think? What kind of money can I expect? I mean, this is all calculated by politics and by events in the world. You know this, dear listener. I'm not saying something to you that's brand new. But I say all of this to just put a bow, however untidy that bow is tied around all of this, to say that we're, as Don Henley would say, and Elton John would say, standing on shaky ground. We are on shaky ground right now. And I think we always have been. I mean, that's no revelation either. And the reason why there is a lot of anxiety is not because President Biden and Vice President Harris are in office. That's not the anxiety. The anxiety is what is going on around them. And I cited what I felt was a little bit of aloofness because, as I said in yesterday's episode, you've got people, you've got these barbarians, these Nazis, nipping at their heels. I just envision this as some major disaster novel, although it's very real. And they're standing there, President Biden, Vice President Harris, on an island of power. It's a lot of power. But the island shrinks so much that it just about covers the bottoms of their shoes. And the growing circle of sharks gets bigger and bigger every week. Until that island barely covers the bottoms of their shoes, the circumference of that island. And it's terrifying. Honestly, dear listener, I'm sorry, but it's terrifying to think that. And I do think that sometimes about what's going on. Because it's so clear you've got this clown at CPAC. You've got all this garbage going on. You've got Democrats like Andrew Cuomo. Obviously, sexual harasser, in my view. Now, I know innocent and proven guilty. I know. And I'm an attorney, so, how does that look for me? But I told you, I believe the survivors. And that's the way I've been forever. That ain't going to change. There's no reason why a woman is going to make that stuff up. It's not stuff. It's her life. And she's not going to put herself on the line like that. And one woman lying does not invalidate the other 99 who are telling the damn truth. Don't even play that game with me either. One woman lying does not invalidate the other 9 million who aren't. You know? I mean, it's just, again, you maximize, you know, people out there, some of them maximizing the minimum and minimizing the maximum. Same thing they did with the number of people who voted for Joe Biden, 81 million people. Oh, but the 74 million, maximizing the minimum. 74 million votes was still 7 million short. And you had people on television acting as if this idiot who lost actually won, which he didn't do. And that plays into this dangerous narrative that got all these violent people, these violent white terrorists, to the Capitol in the first place. And he'd been doing this for a year, and you had these pundits weighing in on it too. Ooh, but 74 million people, that's a lot. And they all contributed to this. If you want to look at blood on hands, you might have to look at some studios that broadcast this news, these news programs. Did you ever think about that? Does it get that insidious? And I'm not only talking about Fox either. Think about that. But we are standing on shaky ground. We are standing on shaky ground. Don Henley and Elton John did a song called Standing on Shaky Ground. I think it's part of the Duets album by Elton John. Go listen to that song. But I will tell you that there is a lot of pressure on this administration, and rightfully so, because 81 million plus people voted for them to actually do things that would help the American public. And they didn't vote for half-ass measures. They voted for the Phil enchilada. They voted for the full enchilada, anchovies, whatever the hell you want to put on it. They wanted it all. And they did not vote for this administration only to see half measures. Even though some of you who voted for him and for Vice President Harris knew that it wasn't going to be some bowl of cherries. I knew that too, if the truth be told. But I wasn't going to spend the election season, the last 2 or 3 months of it, going on about, well, this is going to be a mediocre situation. I wasn't going to do that because the urgency of getting Joe Biden in there was paramount after what you'd seen for 4 years. But I always did say that you have to, that I will challenge and criticize Joe Biden as the day is long. I never shrunk from that. I raised critical questions about him in April of last year with Tara Reid, because I still maintain that he did rape Tara Reid. And I invoke my own complicity in all of this by voting for who I think is a rapist. It's a very uncomfortable thing, especially when I feel so strongly about ending this toxic masculinity and voting for Joe Biden, when I strongly believe he did rape Tara Reid. That's kind of a vote for toxic masculinity, isn't it? Based upon Tara Reid's accusations. And now Andrew Cuomo and Madison Cawthorn. Both of those guys should be thrown out of their political offices. Madison Cawthorn's a Republican and Andrew Cuomo is the Democratic governor of New York State. Both of them. Madison Cawthorn, who is a Republican in Congress. He should be thrown out of that job right now, pending an investigation. And if the investigation finds and there's a trial and they find out that no, he didn't harass, then maybe he gets his job back after that. Then he gets his job back. If they find that he did, he should be gone. He should be gone now, pending the investigation. And Cuomo should be out, pending any kind of action. But I just think he should be out anyway. Both of them should be out anyhow. Because this is just disgusting. I am fed up of these toxic men destroying people's lives, destroying women's lives, first and foremost, but destroying people's lives in general. And this kind of nonsense of, oh, I was just talking to her, and if I my banter may have been inappropriate. Really? And you've got 3 women at least now who've come forward. And there's going to be more. And Al Franken should have gone too. And I'm happy that he is gone. Because he was arrogant. He was wrong. And yes, he didn't do the kinds of things that Harvey Weinstein did. But that's not the point. That's not the point. And should there be a look at, okay, well, he did this and it's still wrong and he's got to go, versus Harvey Weinstein did this and it's wrong and he's got to go as well? It's got to be done. Maybe. But it still does not absolve Al Franken of his conduct. When you've got 8 women who've said that this guy did things to them. Come on. What's wrong is wrong. No matter what the degree of wrong is, it's still wrong. And he had to go. He should have gone. Madison Cawthorn should go. Andrew Cuomo should go. And all of this contributes to this destabilizing place that we are in right now. because Trump should have never been in office. And Lord knows how many women have made it very clear that he should never have been there. And what he did to those women, E. Jean Carroll among them. And this guy is even trying to hint that he's going to try to run again. I don't think he will, by the way. It's all a big tease so that he can get money, so that he can get his media empire. I'm telling you, that's what this is, the long game. It will be Ivanka who'll be running, whether it's for senator in Florida or whether it will be for president. That's who's going to be doing the running. Believe me, it ain't going to be him. But this administration has got to really do even more. And I think, generally speaking, they've been good. But where they've fallen down for me in the last week plus has been, and I've detailed this, the military attack in Syria, the airstrikes in Syria, definitely a huge no-no. And, you know, tantamount to a war crime in some ways. And where was the authorization to Congress? I know that no president has done any authorizations to Congress since World War II. I know that, but still. What happened to all this diplomacy? And to tell me that retaliation is on the table, oh, well, that's the reason. It's not an excuse, as I said before, a few episodes ago. And this also creeps into the testimony of Christopher Wray. It all contributes. There seems to be this enormous disconnection from reality, a kind of indifference. And as you heard those four senators voicing their displeasure, if only you could have seen the look on Christopher Wray's face. Are we safer? Are we? Where's the investigation into these attacks? Where's the investigation into how on earth Donald Trump, well, we know how, but Donald Trump allowing, at the time he was in office, over 400,000 people to die. He killed them. He didn't have to physically do it to each and every, but he did kill them because he didn't act and he chose not to act. Where's the investigation into that? Where is it? I know he got acquitted again last month, but where's the investigation into those hundreds of thousands of people who died on his watch? Where's that investigation in Congress? And as I keep saying, the system's not going to investigate itself. Although it seems like we have crossed into a different administration, and we most certainly have. And though it seems that for the balance of it, for the most part, except for Syria and except for, well, I am not really going to do much about the Senate parliamentarian, which he should do. And, well, we're not going to take any action against MBS in Saudi Arabia for killing an American journalist. We're not going to take any action about that. We're on very, very shaky ground. Very shaky ground indeed. And yes, we've got a new administration, and yes, that's a good thing, and yes, vaccinations are happening, and I think President Biden has done very well there, ahead of the curve on the vaccinations, the number of people with at least one jab so far of the two that they're going to be getting. So far, so good. And local and state efforts have to be much better. But we are on some major shaky ground security-wise right now. And this drone strike, or excuse me, I keep saying drone, this missile strike inside Saudi Arabia, killing at least 22 people, last time I checked, maybe it's more than that now, makes us even less safe as a country, as a nation. And I do wonder what Jake Sullivan is up to. What is he doing? I do wonder what the Homeland Security advisor is doing, the Homeland Security chief. Mayorkas. I'm wondering, Alejandro Mayorkas, what's Ali Mayorkas doing right now? I am really concerned about the infrastructure. The infrastructure. Education, Cardona was confirmed yesterday, or the day before now. I think it was Monday. Yeah, the day before yesterday. And he's got to get to work. The new UN ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the UN, and the new, I believe she's also the General Assembly leader in the UN as well. Linda Thomason, Bridgehill, I believe is her name. Linda Thomason. And I may not have her proper name correct there. I may apologize. But the new ambassador, she's going to have to get up and running pretty soon. She had her first press conference on Monday. There are a lot of challenges, and there's a lot going on domestically. These white domestic, you know, these white terrorists. There's so much going on. And then again, where's the COVID relief? Where is that now? Where is that relief gone? People are waiting. There's still people on food bank lines. People are still waiting for relief. They're waiting. They're still on hours long food lines for food banks. Working class, middle class, working poor, they're all still. And meanwhile, you've got rich people jumping ahead of the line to get vaccinated. We are just a step or two away from this whole place going up in flames. And if this Democratic administration does not get this right, and if the FBI director flippantly and blithely walks along whistling in the dark, I really do worry about this country's direction. And I know you do too, dear listener. 2022 is around the corner, and these gun-toting Republicans will end up getting back in and taking control of the House if the Speaker of the House and her fellow corporate Democratic cohorts keep spitting at people who dare say defund the police. There is a fissure already. There's been a fissure in the Democratic Party for 30 years around the corporate entity that has taken over it and the true progressives who tried to hold on and fight back to bring the party back to FDR roots, where the working class was thought about first ahead of the donor class, where the people and the working people were thought of first ahead of the rich and the 10%ers, top 10%, that is. We have so much to deal with here, and people are dissatisfied, the fuses are short, people are turning to crime. And I'm telling you, in a moment of madness, fueled by frustration and the indifference of the Democratic administration, we could go back to a Trump-style presidency, a Trump-style House Republican takeover, and a Senate takeover. I mean, it's all right there. And if the Democratic Party chooses to turn its back, and an FBI director chooses to just blithely ignore the warnings, the same warnings that he himself invoked on a number of occasions, safety and safe are going to be a thing of the past. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It's all happening at the Politocrat Daily Podcast online store, and you can go there right now at the-politocrat.myshopify.com. Lots of good new items, brand new, designed by yours truly. So please head to the Politocrat Daily Podcast online store now. Thank you very much.